Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
From Film Nation Entertainment, this is Hypothetical, the show where what-ifs become now-whats. I'm your host, Carrie Bechet. In last week's episode, The Flood, we asked, what if sea levels rose by 6 feet? And this week, consider enhancing your Earth Day celebration with this extended interview with our featured scientist, Dr. Twyla Moon. Dr. Moon is a glaciologist, an expert in all things ice. Really big ice. And you'd be surprised to learn just how these pockets of really big ice affect all our lives in really big ways. If you're listening in New York City, for instance, and you think rats, weather, traffic, and train delays are the only thing affecting your commute, well, I've got news for you. You might have to start factoring in the state of the Antarctic ice shelf into your travel time. Grab your galoshes and embark on our journey with Dr. Moon.
What got you into studying glaciers in the first place?
Well, I always have been interested in science. I was interested in science and art all growing up. And when I got to college, I had a pretty good sense that I'd be a scientist of one sort or another. And I grew up in the outdoors. I've always been interested in earth sciences. But when I was a sophomore in college, I had an opportunity to study abroad in Nepal, and we trekked up north along the eastern border between Nepal and Bhutan, and we got up to Kanchenjunga, which is one of the highest peaks in the world. And there, you can imagine these long snaking glaciers that come down from these high Himalayan peaks. And we walked up the valley to one, and it was the first time I'd ever seen a big glacier in person. And I kind of wandered off by myself, and it was summer and the ice is melting, so you can hear water dropping and rocks falling, and it felt alive. And I thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a glaciologist.
I love that.
And really, the rest is history.
What a beautiful sort of origin story.
It was very much instantaneous realization of my future.
It's so interesting to hear you describe a glacier as alive. I think we all think of ice as kind of like the death of all life. And so to think of a glacier itself as sort of a living, moving, life-giving sort of thing is so interesting.
Yeah, I definitely think of ice as alive. One of the things that makes a glacier, in fact, maybe one of the most important things, is that it's moving. So glaciers are very slow rivers, and that sense of motion you get in small mountain glaciers and also large ice sheets. And I've spent a lot of time studying that motion and movement, and I very much think of both small and large ice as something that's living and sort of breathing.
What do glaciers look like when you come upon one in a valley like that?
So the way they look can change a lot depending on where you are and what kind of glacier you're looking at. That kind of glacier that I was seeing there in Nepal, I was seeing the ends of it down in the valley. So you can imagine that that's really the only ice that's there. Otherwise, you have bare ground and brown rocks. And down in that area, the glacier, it might snow on it in winter, but in summer, it's going to lose all of that snow and it's going to continue to melt more ice. And so it's actually really dirty. Lots of rock and sediment all over it. A very highly textured surface, so crevasses and kind of mini hills and valleys, and it'll get pools that form on it and ponds and a lot of texture. Not an easy place to walk around, really hard to move around on a glacier surface like that. And even to get down to it often, because glaciers around the world are retreating, that means that they've left these high stands up on their edges, which we call moraines. And those are just a big conglomeration of rock and sand and sediment, and they can be really hard to travel on. That looks pretty different than if you are headed to Greenland, for example, where I spend a lot of time doing work. And the ice sheet there, the center of the Greenland ice sheet, is more than 2 miles thick. And all of that ice, as it's moving out from the interior out to the ocean, has not had a lot of interaction with the rock or sediment.
You mentioned it had sounds associated with it. What did that glacier in Nepal sound like?
Yeah, so that glacier in Nepal, like I said, I was there in summer. So that's the melt season. And that's when you're hearing drip, drops, drips, and you're hearing the kind of watery, gravelly sounds. And then if you're going to other areas, so that was a glacier that just ends on land, right? But a lot of the glaciers I study are glaciers that end in the ocean. And that's where we get calving of big icebergs. And the noise of calving is incredible. It's incredibly loud and rumbly. So even if you were, for example, traveling up to Alaska and you were seeing what on a global scale would be a relatively small glacier, I want to clarify, you personally would probably think it was really huge. But when it comes to what we can see around the globe, it's pretty small. And even there where you get, again, what would be relatively small amounts of ice, you know, square meters of ice falling off, the noise of it, the rumble like thunder, and then that fall into the water and the waves that cascade out from it. It's such a noisy event.
So these calving of icebergs, is that what is causing sea levels to rise? Icebergs break off of big glaciers and then they travel to warmer places and they melt and the sea level rises?
So they're one of the components that's causing sea levels to rise. Sea levels are rising because we're losing land ice. So first, that's really important to understand, is that there's ice that's floating on the ocean, sea ice or ice shelves, we call them, that are around a lot of areas of Antarctica. Once that ice is floating on the ocean, it's already done its job. It's changed sea levels. And sea ice is being formed and then melted out of ocean water. So it's not changing ocean levels at all. But this ice that's sitting on land, that is the ice that as we lose, we're changing the ocean levels. And when it comes to Greenland and Antarctica, the way we lose ice is different between those large ice sheets. In Greenland, somewhere in the 30 to 60% is happening from calving of icebergs. And then basically, as soon as that iceberg's calved, it's in the ocean and it's displaced water. And it actually doesn't matter where it melts for sea level rise. And then the other part of ice that we're losing from Greenland is melting directly. It's either getting melted at those edges by the ocean or it's melting on the surface. And that melt is traveling through the ice sheet out from underneath the edges of it and adding to sea level rise. So both direct melt and this solid ice, both of those things are contributing to sea level rise.
Are there other ways that the sea level rises other than ice melting?
Yes. So the other largest component of sea level rise is ocean thermal expansion. That's the idea that as you're warming up water, the density of water changes. So water molecules, right, H2O, oxygen, and two hydrogens, they're attached to each other in a specific way. And depending on the temperature, that molecule is going to be more or less dense. So just as we're heating up the ocean, it is expanding.
Has that contributed to sea level rise already?
Yes. The sea level rise that we've already had today, the major contributors are this expansion because the ocean is warming up and loss of ice. And today, actually, the sea level that we see, the biggest contributors from ice are these smaller glaciers around the world because they've been more readily able to melt. You can imagine they're at lower latitudes. You might find them in North America or in the Andes or Patagonia, and then Greenland.
How much has thermal expansion already increased sea levels, and how much more will thermal expansion alone increase sea level rise?
It doesn't have as much ability to raise ocean waters in the future as loss of sea ice. So you can still get a meter or more of sea level rise from ocean warming, but just the timescales that we think of over coming hundreds and thousands of years, we're likely to see more contribution from land ice and not as much from ocean warming. But both of them will continue to increase.
Let's just kind of start with sort of a bigger question. How do sea levels rise?
That is a big question. So sea level rise means different things on different scales. So often we hear people talk about mean sea level rise, or we hear scientists talk about mean sea level rise. That's just some average spread out over the entire globe. But in reality, no individual place is experiencing mean sea level rise. You're experiencing local sea level rise, and your local sea level rise is going to be a combination of multiple different components. So one of the components is what's happening locally in your own geology. So, for example, if you live in the U.S.'s Gulf Coast, a lot of the land there is actually subsiding. It's actually going down naturally. So you would think that sea level was rising even if there wasn't more water in the ocean because the land you're living on is losing elevation. So part of your local sea level rise is just what's happening to your local geology and landscape. But the other part of sea level rise is where that water in the ocean is being moved and where it's coming from. So you can imagine that where our water is circulated by the ocean, that's moving water into different places. So for example, in the Pacific, a lot of the water in the Pacific actually gets piled up more on the west side, closer over to Asia, and less on the east side around California. So the currents of the ocean are actually moving water and piling it up in different places. The atmosphere also does that, and atmospheric winds can push that ocean water towards one place and away from another, and that's going to influence the locations that sea level rise is felt. And then another thing that's going to influence is that the mass of ice sitting in a large ice sheet actually works like a magnet. It has gravitational pull, and it pulls the ocean water around it towards that mass of ice. And so as we lose ice from that mass, we're losing our ability to pull the ocean towards us. And that means that if I lose ice in Greenland, the largest sea level rise from that is happening far away in, for example, the southern hemisphere. Or if I lose a lot of ice from Antarctica, I'm going to feel its effects most strongly in the northern hemisphere. So in New York, you are going to care quite a lot about what's happening in Antarctica, but maybe not quite as much with what's happening in Greenland, or maybe just some more distant areas of Greenland.
I imagine it affects, we're talking about temperature, and we're also talking about, I guess, changing the salinity of the ocean water if large pieces of ice melt into it. So is one of the concerns changing ocean currents?
Yeah, changing ocean currents are an impact of changing ice sheets, and we see differences. You hear people talk about the meridional overturning circulation. This is the kind of circulation that happens through the northern Atlantic, comes down the eastern coast of the U.S., on the other side is moving around past parts of Europe. And as we're changing, exactly what you said, as we're changing the salinity and the temperature of the water that it's picking up, we're able to change those currents. So ice sheets are not the primary driver of the current circulation we see around the globe, but they are an element that influences it, and we can already see some changes in some of the currents on Earth and how quickly they're moving. But I would say for the most part, those are changes that are happening a bit more slowly and not something that you're going to worry about, for example, on whether you should buy a house on the beach.
Part of what you're saying is rising sea level, when we talk about that, we're sort of, it lacks some nuance in that we're kind of generalizing and saying the sea level will rise an average of 6 feet or 8 feet in the next 80 years or 100 years. I'd actually love, how much will the water levels rise by, say, 2100?
Boy, if I could tell you that, I would put a lot of people out of a scientific job. So there's a wide range of what we expect sea level might do by 2100. And really, one of the very biggest factors that's influencing what that number is what people do. Because all of these changes in our Earth system, in our ice sheets, they're changes that are in response to the warming that we're creating in the atmosphere, the warming we're creating in the ocean, and we're creating that via our greenhouse gas emissions. So what people do over the next coming decades is the biggest question mark in determining what is sea level rise going to look like in your city in 2100. But we do have a pretty good sense that with some of the action that we've already taken as people, some of the emissions we've already made, we've baked in a loss of ice for the next few decades. So we have a pretty good sense that some of these changes are coming no matter what.
So if the worst happened and by 2100, the sea levels rose an average of 6 feet around the world, what would the world look like?
Well, you can imagine taking a map of coastlines and just throwing it out the window, because you're going to have really different coastlines. And you can look at today's topography and think, Florida. Florida is incredibly low-lying. So we're just going to eat in at all of those low-lying edges. The bottom tips of Florida is going to disappear. It's going to get eaten around the edges. It's almost as though the Cookie Monster came around and just started nibbling at all of those low-lying edges. And it's going to look different in different places. So the East Coast of the U.S. and the Gulf Coast of the U.S. are going to be having a lot harder time than areas along the West Coast. Not that the West Coast won't be impacted, but the size of that impact is going to be different. And you can imagine that places that already struggle with keeping the ocean at bay and have big seawalls are going to be facing that much more difficulty, and might find that instead of having a flood once or twice a year, that they're flooded all the time.
Do you think these cities and these coastal areas will become uninhabitable, just utterly uninhabitable? Will we have to abandon New York or New Orleans?
This is such a difficult question. People want to be able to stay where they are, right? We have roots. We have generations of roots in these different places. And what it looks like to retreat or to move somewhere else can feel really dramatic. So someone who wants to stay in place, they might need to build their house on 10-foot-tall poles, essentially, or they might need to more often get places from their house in a boat and not in a car. So I think there will be people who are tied to that place and find ways to stay in that place, but they're probably going to lose the infrastructure and the community they have. You can imagine if I'm a business, it's going to be pretty hard for me to make money off of people driving up to my business if my parking lot is under a couple feet of water, right? It's going to be hard for me to take goods or keep them and find ways to store them. So I think more and more communities will have to discuss, how do we relocate? How do we move to certain parts of our land that are higher up? How do we create economies in those spaces? And those are really complex questions that run everything from development rights to how does a town or a county, where is its tax base? And you don't want to lose all your taxpayers because they're moving somewhere else. And then how do you take care of your infrastructure? Not let alone the cultural parts of moving from a place that you've grown up in or your family has owned for a long time. But at some point, nature will have her way. And there's only so much we can do to hold back the oceans.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
I have so many questions for you. Are there any analogous places in the world where sea levels have already risen, where we can kind of maybe take their example and see what it might be like for other communities around the world? And what are the things that they're currently doing? I guess building houses on stilts, building seawalls, land reclamation. I don't know. What are the things that people are currently doing, and where in the world are they doing that?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we already see sea level rise around the world. Sea level rise is already a reality. And we see people and communities using all of those things that you mentioned and more. And that's where it becomes such a local decision based on financial resources based on, are you a big country or a little country or a big city or a little city? And what are people willing to talk about? Often it can be really difficult to talk about fixing a problem that people can't quite see yet. So I was actually just on Monday, I was in Annapolis, Maryland, and talking with it was a group of scientists and stakeholder decision maker folks getting together to try and understand each other and figure out how we can talk more effectively about sea level rise. And there in the city of Annapolis, they already see significantly more flooding in their downtown area than they did in the past. So many more days a year, they have flooded parking lots and flooded businesses. And they have decided, we want these businesses to stay here for this time being, and we're going to make a plan that is a plan for our next decade. And they actually, the problem is they have seawalls, but they have storm drains that don't keep the water out, right? The storm drains were designed to take the water from inland and allow it to drain into the ocean. But of course, they're open conduits for that ocean water to come inland as well. So even though they have seawalls, flooding's coming up through the storm drains. So they have an entire engineering project to retrofit their storm drains so that they can pump water out of their storm drains and again return more of the protection value to the seawalls that they have. And they're not getting this flooding happening from inland, essentially. There are other places where those kinds of dollars might be a challenge. And we see, for example, Bangladesh is a low-lying country. It's already seen significant influences from sea level rise. And there, we have a lot of people moving from rural coastal areas into city regions.
I love this idea of a real cultural shift, that there's new jobs, new infrastructure, new inventions to kind of deal with this changing world. You know, it sounds like such an apocalyptic outcome. And I really love this sort of more humanist idea that science is the thing that's going to help us deal with these complicating factors. I have a friend who grew up in North Carolina, and he was a boat valet. He'd be on the dock, and people would drive up their boats to go to the bar, and he'd take your boat and go park it in a place for you. And I like this idea that we might just have sort of a different culture spring up around the necessities of this new world, like a seawall maintenance man is going to be a job.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we're going to see a really wide variety of different actions that people are taking, depending on whether they're willing to move, whether they're determined to stay in place, what their financial resources look like for doing any of those things. But we can expect our coasts to look different, and the impacts of hurricanes to feel different. And we're going to be forced to make changes. And the best thing we can do is think about it proactively.
So I'm trying to imagine a very quotidian day in the life of a person who lives, say, in New York City, maybe in a time when the water levels have risen, say, 6 feet. I'm trying to imagine what sort of concerns they'd have, kind of what sort of economic cultural activity they'd see, what sort of health impacts they'd personally have to protect against. I don't know, what is that, like mold? Or, you know, I'm curious about kind of like on a very micro level, what do you imagine like a day in the life of a person in this kind of imaginary future world would be like?
So I might still get up and make a cup of coffee and eat my breakfast and read the paper, but then maybe I'm having to do it in a third floor apartment because I had to move out of my first floor apartment because that was flooded and nothing exists on that first floor of the building anymore, essentially. And now maybe I leave my apartment building by taking a ramp to something else, and I have to walk from point A to point B because I can't take the subway anymore because it's flooded.
I'm kind of picturing like a Venice, Italy type situation where there's just canals of water flowing through the avenues and, you know, like yellow taxi cabs are now yellow water taxi cabs.
The thing is, it's going to be this slower change. So even if change happens rapidly, as in we get 6 feet of mean sea level rise in the next 80 years, which would be a lot of sea level rise in not very much time, it's still going to be incrementally happening. You know, Monday this year is going to look a little different than Monday next year and then next year. And so it's going to happen slowly, and different people are probably going to take different tacks. I'm going to say, oh, well, this year in my neighborhood, it floods, you know, twice a year, and it's a super pain in my butt, but I just work from home that day, or something like that. Well, then 5 years down the line, now it's flooding in my neighborhood like 10 days out of a year, and it's becoming really a problem, and I might consider moving to this other neighborhood. And then another 20 years down the line, and it's flooding like 40 days out of the year in my neighborhood, and the businesses have decided to move somewhere else, or, you know, maybe my community, we got together when it was flooding 10 days out of the year, and we decided, man, we really like this place, but we understand this is going to happen more and more, so we're going to build some infrastructure so that we can exist in this water world of a neighborhood. People are going to be making those decisions along the way. There are going to be some groups that are proactive about it and can imagine this future. But I think actually a lot of people are going to be pretty reactive to it.
Have you heard of the term climate gentrification?
No. Tell me about climate gentrification.
Well, I think it's kind of along the lines of what we're discussing is maybe the different ways that different communities are affected by climate change. So it may be more of a political, societal issue than strictly a scientific one. But it's sort of this conversation about who will be most adversely affected by a sea level rise and who, if anyone, stands to benefit.
Yeah, I can imagine, too, that wrapped up in there, you also have this real difference between people's ability to plan to take advantage of climate change and inability to take advantage of climate change. And I imagine that's part of what you're talking about. So it's a sort of like, well, I have more money. I know that flooding's coming. I'm going to sell off my coastal property and I'm going to buy a property over here, which is going to be in a great location to be once all of this flooding comes. Because I have the means to do that. Whereas someone else, if they sold their home on the coast, where would they live? You know, maybe they can't afford to buy a home in that place that's a little bit higher up and a little bit more protected. So I can very much imagine this issue. I mean, we see the same thing happen on the national level where you have countries like the U.S. that, frankly, are going to be a lot better off than countries like Bangladesh that we were talking about earlier. Bangladesh, that's a poor country. They don't have a lot of resources to help their citizens and to help change economies and adjust. Developed, wealthier nations have a lot more resources to help citizens out with infrastructure or moving them around or adjusting economies.
Do you imagine that there would be a kind of like business opportunities for anyone here, creating some kind of product or invention?
Yeah, I think if you're wanting to make money off of events happening from sea level rise, there are going to be opportunities. I mean, you are the person who is cleaning up after floods. You are the person who is inventing technologies to protect freshwater sources for drinking water. You are the person who's designing engineering systems to help get water out of the storm drains. You are the person who is mapping out low-level housing places and trying to make money off of selling that real estate before things get really bad and anyone's paying attention. You're the person who's designing a development in a place that's not going to be inundated by flooding. Whether you might feel really good about making your money off of these things coming might be another matter. And I imagine that there will be new technologies designed, especially in that space where people don't want to move.
What is keeping us from taking advantage of those technologies, do you think?
I would say politics, particularly in the U.S., is not helping us to take advantage of those inventions. Change is difficult. So if I'm in a place here and I'm living my comfortable life and I start speculating on climate change and should I be doing something or, you know, should I be thinking about solar energy or wind energy or these other elements, and someone comes along and says, well, you know, those scientists, they aren't 100% sure. They don't all 100% agree. I think, oh, great. I don't need to do anything, right? Maintaining the status quo is the easy job. And unfortunately, we've had some pretty strong actors and some big dollars, particularly in the U.S., that are really interested in maintaining this status quo. And that makes it easy for me not to do anything, for my city not to adopt anything, for my state not to change its ways or think more about encouraging renewable energy instead of fossil fuel energy technologies and industries. And so some of those things, just changing public opinion, providing people a real sense of urgency and need. We have a lot of difficulty fixing a problem that we can't fully see yet. And climate change fits into that. Even though we can see dramatic impacts from climate change today already, more dramatic ones are in store for us ahead of us. But we don't yet see those in our day-to-day life. So that can be pretty hard to motivate people for change. So I think just the ease of maintaining the status quo is a big roadblock to implementing some of the changes that would be most beneficial to us in the longer term.
I wonder, you're talking about sort of a distant future beyond 2100 and beyond this kind of hypothetical 6-foot sea level rise. What do you imagine to be the most extreme ultimate outcome? How long do you think it'll take us to get there? Will all the ice on Earth melt? What will the world be like then?
Yeah, I would say if we continue with high levels of emissions and we start to reach carbon dioxide parts per million that are up around, you know, 1,000 parts per million. Today, we're at just over 400. We're at about 410 parts per million, which is already more than our planet's seen in hundreds of thousands of years, way before people were around. But if we continue to put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and we're reaching out into this 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 parts per million, that's when we start to see a future when 5,000 or 10,000 years from now, we don't really have ice sheets anymore. And sea levels might be 30 or 40 meters, so 90 or 120 feet higher than they are today. And those are changes in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere that we have the capacity to create over just a couple hundred years. The amount of emissions that we can put into the atmosphere is unprecedented. That's not something that nature could produce in her wildest dreams. But we've invented amazing technologies that brought us heat, that brought us transportation, that brought us electricity, that can take the carbon of the earth, burn it, give us all of these fantastic advantages, and boom, it goes into the atmosphere. And we have the ability to put that carbon into the atmosphere really rapidly. And once we have started that warming, and once we've gotten past kind of a certain amount of ice loss, that ice loss is continuing. That carbon is staying in the atmosphere for thousands of years. And that's when we see these tens or maybe 100 feet of sea level rise out in 5 or 10,000 years from now.
Is ice loss and sea level rise reversible?
I would say that ice loss from these large ice sheets and from land-based ice is not possible for me right now to imagine a point where we have created reversible loss, where we've actually managed to grow ice. I can imagine a future where we have implemented technology, so we're taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we're cooling the climate, and in that way, or at least maybe stabilizing the climate, and in that way, we might be able to, for example, get more sea ice again, something like that that can form kind of year to year, or we might get longer, our winters would stop shrinking, and we would get snow earlier in fall and snow sticking around later in spring. Growing ice sheets, though, is a process that happens over tens of thousands of years. And even if we stabilize our climate today, we're not going to see growth of land ice.
What is the worst case scenario that you could imagine in terms of sea level rise by 2100?
So if we had all of the bad scenarios combining, humans continue to put out lots and lots of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, some of the processes that we're not certain actually occur on ice sheets, it turned out that they really did happen, and we could lose ice sheets very quickly. That's when we start to think about numbers that could reach the 6 feet or more by 2100. All of the worst scenarios combined.
And that would result in a 6-foot sea level rise, an 8-foot sea level rise, or we just don't know?
It's still being sorted out as we understand the potential processes of how ice sheets can collapse and how quickly they can collapse. So a year ago, there was science that said, well, there might be this process of collapsing ice cliffs that could happen in Antarctica and make us lose that ice sheet really quickly. And if that actually was a process that happened in the real world, then you might talk about 8 feet of mean global sea level rise by 2100. But then work since then suggests, well, we don't see that process happening today in the ice sheet. And it seems like maybe such dramatic losses can't happen at that time scale. So now we might tamp down that very high-end estimate by a couple of feet. But I would say there's still a lot of science underway to understand what that worst-case scenario could look like. And again, that worst-case scenario still critically depends on what people are doing. So if we are getting our act together and we're not putting quite so many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that's helping us avoid the worst-case scenarios.
Hypothetical is a production of Film Nation Entertainment in association with Transmitter Media. It's distributed by Realm. The series was created by Milan Popelka and is executive produced by Greta Cohn and Milan Popelka. It's produced by Caitlin Pierce and Michaela Salella with Oluwakemi Aladisui and with help from Todd Whitney. This bonus interview was edited by Tori Smith with additional editing from Alyssa Martino. Music by Dara Hirsch. Special thanks to Dr. Twyla Moon and the Science and Entertainment Exchange for connecting us to brilliant scientists like her. Additional thanks to Allison Cohen from Film Nation Entertainment.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.